It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin will once again be a critical swing state in the 2024 presidential election. The campaigns of both Joe Biden and Donald Trump have been paying a lot of attention around here lately. Political analysts are going to spend the next 7 months trying to figure out what Wisconsin voters will decide. Recent polling shows some big trends to keep an eye on. Our next guest has dug into what he sees as important differences between Democratic and Republican voters when it comes to regional divisions in the state and overall enthusiasm about the election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you enthusiastic? Are you excited about the 2024 election? Are you eager to vote for your candidate this November? Are you already tired of the election? Can't wait for it to be over? Are you lacking motivation to participate? Are you voting against more than four, do you think, in November? Or do you want to not pay attention yet? It's still 7 months off. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Craig Gilbert is a Lubar Center Fellow at Marquette University Law School. He was the longtime Washington Bureau Chief from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's written lately in the Journal Sentinel about an enthusiasm gap among voters and comparisons of the political landscapes of 2016, 2020, and 2024. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Let's start with an enthusiasm gap you wrote about a couple weeks ago. One party might look at this and be pretty worried. Which way is that gap going?
Well, it's going against the Democrats right now. They're expressing not only less enthusiasm than Republicans about the 2024 election, but their enthusiasm is easily at kind of a 10-year low in the polling that we do at Marquette. Now, this could change, but it's not a great sign for Democrats, but it also reflects the fact that, and you kind of alluded to this just now, that Democrats seem to be voting more against Donald Trump than for Joe Biden. It doesn't mean they're not motivated to vote. In fact, in some of the national polling, you know, Democrats have been more likely to vote than Republicans, but they're not expressing enthusiasm about the election. They fear a Trump victory. And, you know, they've seen a lot of polls in the last few months, you know, suggesting that could happen. And that may be a little bit demoralizing, but it's going to be really interesting going forward to watch and see whether enthusiasm is really a barometer of turnout or not.
Right. I could see an enthusiastic Democratic voter being a couple different things. One might be they weren't nuts about Biden maybe in the first place or not now. They're hoping for somebody different. Therefore, they might not show up or they might think about third party or something like that. Or it could be, yeah, they would have liked to see maybe a different candidate this time around, but of course they're going to show up and vote for somebody other than Donald Trump. How easy is it to translate enthusiasm into how and whether people vote?
Yeah, no, it's not a direct barometer. It really isn't. And, you know, we've seen in some past election cycles where it has kind of tracked with the outcome of the election, but this is kind of an unusual time when you've got so many people unhappy with both nominees, and Donald Trump is a unique figure. He's kind of a motivating and mobilizing figure to voters in both parties. He's, you know, obviously he's got a lot of Republican voters who are excited about him, but he's also got a lot of Democratic voters who are really all about stopping Donald Trump from becoming the next president or becoming president again. And so it's not a perfect by any means barometer of turnout. And like I said, in some of the other turnout barometers we look to, they have actually advantaged the Democrats in some polling. Marquette just had a national poll where Joe Biden, you know, led nationally among the most likely voters, but was in a tie with Donald Trump among, you know, less likely voters and trailed him among the least likely voters. So you've got a lot of different things going on there. The Democratic base in some ways is now kind of higher levels of education than the Republican base, and that can be a barometer of turnout. So there are clearly a lot of casual voters who are very supportive of Donald Trump. He may have an advantage among the most casual voters, which means turnout is of particular importance and a particular challenge on the Republican side, just as Democrats have to deal with these enthusiasm questions.
Now, an interesting thing, and you've written some about this, Craig, if you looked at Joe Biden and the negatives in polling, unfavorability ratings, that sort of thing, if you looked at that in isolation, you might say there's no way this candidate with these ratings could win an election. If you look at Donald Trump and the negatives in favorability, things like that, in isolation, you'd say there's no way this candidate can win for president. Probably one of those two guys is going to win. They could only beat each other in some ways.
Yeah, and it makes it very difficult to predict, because for several reasons. One is that you're dealing, again, with about 20% of the electorate that dislikes both candidates. That did happen in 2016. And a big reason why Donald Trump won the 2016 election in the key states was that those voters, the so-called double haters, broke for Trump late and against Hillary Clinton. He won that group. So he got the votes of a lot of people that expressed negative perceptions of Donald Trump. But now, again, you've got two candidates, a president and a former president, that both have relatively high negatives. So it's very hard to predict the behavior of voters who were down on both sides. And it's also, like you said, it's easy if you're an analyst to kind of talk yourself into the idea that either Donald Trump, there's no way Donald Trump could win with his negatives. There's no way Joe Biden could win with his low approval ratings. And so it's kind of trying to match up their political liabilities to see which ones are greater is a really, a really vexing exercise.
Talking to Craig Gilbert, looking at the 2024 presidential election race, enthusiasm or lack of same among voters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you one of those double haters? Or maybe you don't use the word hate, but you dislike both major party candidates. Have you been there in the last couple elections? What did you ultimately decide to do? Do you feel, whatever you're leaning toward here right now, do you feel enthusiastic, excited, resigned, disappointed in our 2024 presidential election? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Craig, you looked within parties to see what kind of support each candidate was getting from their own side. You found something interesting on Republicans. A decent proportion, not huge, decent proportion opposed to Donald Trump, but it breaks down very differently depending on where you are in the state. What are we seeing?
Yeah, if you remember 8 years ago, we had a big primary in Wisconsin. And what was interesting about it was that it was Donald Trump's last big defeat on his way to the Republican nomination in 2016. And there was this massive kind of regional divide among Republican voters, voters kind of in southeastern Wisconsin, both in Milwaukee County and the more Republican Wow counties, really, really disliked Donald Trump. But Republican voters to the north and to the west were much more positive about Donald Trump. Those divisions were really dramatic, and they kind of disappeared when Donald Trump became president. And he really kind of peaked in popularity among Republican voters. And you didn't have these big splits between suburban Republicans and rural Republicans. But now they've kind of resurfaced. And so Donald Trump is certainly more popular with Republican voters than he was during the 2016 nominating fight, but he's not as popular with the Republican voters as he was when he was president. And you've got these divisions again, where he's still really popular among Republican voters in the smaller TV markets in Wisconsin, particularly in the North and the West and Central Wisconsin, but considerably less popular, you know, in the Madison TV market and in parts of the Milwaukee TV market. So that to me says that Donald Trump is not does not unify his party the way he did when he was in the White House. And he's got his work cut out for him, because that also matches up with the voting patterns we've seen in recent statewide elections where Republicans have lost ground in suburban Wisconsin.
And polls show, you write, Craig, that Joe Biden doesn't have universal support among Wisconsin Democrats, still like Trump, a solid, very substantial majority. But you don't see that regional division amongst Democrats.
You really don't. Now, one place we saw it a little bit was in this primary, which, again, is a select group of people that are voting in a kind of a low interest primary, two presidential primaries that were basically uncontested. But what you did see was, you know, there was a campaign to get people to choose uninstructed, which was just sort of a way of sending a signal to Joe Biden that some people are unhappy, particularly in his own party, particularly over the war in Gaza. And that those uninstructed column did better in Dane County and Milwaukee County than it did in the rest of the state. So there you see a little bit of a regional divide. But whether that translates in a general election, you know, 7 months from now into, you know, depressed support or turnout in these two base Milwaukee areas, I think is a totally different question.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert about his analysis in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel looking at the 2024 election landscape in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of those regional divides, especially when it comes to Republican attitudes toward Donald Trump we're seeing here in Wisconsin? Do you think that could swing the election? What do you think that Biden could do to connect more with voters in those rural areas? How about Trump reaching out to the suburban and urban voters? Join in with your attitude toward the 2024 election at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Craig Gilbert, longtime Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now Lubar Center Fellow at Marquette University's Law School, with us today to look at political divides among Wisconsin voters when it comes to things like election enthusiasm in 2024, regional splits, and more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How enthusiastic are you about this election? Whether you're talking about presidential or state elections, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, Rob, how's your Monday going?
Not too bad so far. What's on your mind, Jack?
Yes, I'm just thinking about this election. So for starters, I want to say that I'm really fired up about this election. We know it's not going to be easy, and I don't want to, you know, channel my inner, you know, armchair TV political analyst here too much, but I personally am fired up. I think about my fellow young people and the fact that, you know, Biden is kind of, or his administration has alienated them with the issues like, you know, the war in Gaza and whatnot. And it would be great, I think, if he could connect more to young people to remind them about what he's doing well for them, not as a distraction from the war stuff. It would be great if, you know, he and his administration could work to resolve that conflict the best way they can, the most peaceful way, I should say, but kind of connect to young people about the issues that matter to them, especially when it comes to the domestic stuff. But yeah, those are my thoughts on the national race. And as for Wisconsin, I'm really looking forward to a sea change in the legislature. And hopefully we can, you know, do more to channel like our previous reputation as a state that was really forward thinking, really innovative.
Jack, I got you. A lot there, Craig. Let's start with that first point. As it happens, President Biden visited Madison today talking about a new student loan partial forgiveness plan. I may be part of an effort to do what Jack is hoping to do, saying that Joe Biden should reach out to more to younger voters. What do we see when we're polling and try to figure out what younger voters are thinking this year?
Yeah, I mean, the polling has been interesting. It's certainly, we've seen lower levels of, you know, the margins for Biden and for Democrats have been smaller than the historic election margins in the polling. Again, that's in the polling. It doesn't mean it's going to happen in November at the polls, but it's kind of a, you know, an alarm call, and the White House is sensitive to that. And you know, it made perfect political sense for Joe Biden to come to Madison, Wisconsin, where there is a significant student vote in a pivotal battleground state, to hit this issue of student debt relief. And so you're going to see, I think, the Biden campaign try to do all sorts of things to energize this part of the electorate. And obviously, they would be helped if the situation on the ground changes in Gaza. If it doesn't change, you know, that's going to be a political challenge. It's a complicated issue because, of course, if you're a young voter, let's say a Democratic-leaning voter who's concerned about the war in Gaza, and you're really unhappy with Joe Biden over this issue, you know, the alternative, of course, is Donald Trump, who is not going to be less supportive of Israel probably than Joe Biden, and may not be the automatic candidate to turn to on this issue if you're unhappy with Joe Biden. So that, you know, then the question is, do people turn out for Biden? Do they vote for Biden? Do they not turn out? Do they vote for a third party candidate? And we haven't talked about that, but that's a really complex set of issues when you think about, you know, the role that RFK Jr. could play in this election. Who is he actually drawing votes away from? Because he's got kind of a small but eclectic constituency. And it's the kind of thing, you know, we talk about a lot of things that can swing an election in a state that's decided by 10 or 20,000 votes. And the third party dynamics are one of those things.
Jack, thanks for the call. Before I go back to our callers, Craig, I wanted to ask about Jack's other point anyway. Our state legislative elections, big change in our election maps. How big an impact could that have?
Yeah, it's really huge. And, you know, whether or not people are enthusiastic about this election, I don't think anyone would deny that the political stakes are really huge. They're huge for control of the White House. They're huge for control of the Senate, of the U.S. Senate. And in Wisconsin, we have this new landscape where, you know, for the last 12 or years or more, we've had maps that have basically ensured large Republican majorities in both chambers of the state legislature. And of course, those maps have been overturned now. We have new maps. And that those maps basically create a level playing field. Certainly, for both chambers of the legislature, it would be very hard for Democrats to win back the state Senate because half of the state Senate seats were chosen in the last election, and Republicans have a big advantage among those seats. But they certainly, in this cycle, could win back the state assembly. So, you know, that's a really big deal in a state where control of the legislature has been very one-sided for more than a decade.
Thanks for the call, Jack. We'll go to Sandra now in Madison. Sandra, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I don't have much confidence in President Biden or that particular office of our United States. I just don't think that I don't exactly know. I see it as kind of like a game playing. And I'm probably not going to vote in November. I did not vote in the primaries. The first time in my life that I just said, whatever. And just don't have the confidence. I just think that things could be done quite easily by President Biden, and they haven't been done. I feel like he's putting a lot of Band-Aids down. There have been a lot of Band-Aids down.
Sandra, thanks a lot for the call. So, Sandra, I think fair to say, Craig, disillusioned, disenchanted with President Biden, with the process as a whole. When people are judging a president by what they have and haven't done, are voters forgiving of things like saying that one of the chambers of Congress is in the other party's hands, and that may limit a president's ability to do stuff?
Yeah, I guess to a point. But, you know, if you're the incumbent, you kind of own, you own it. I mean, people will basically hold you responsible for conditions. And we've seen a lot of dissatisfaction, a lot of general disillusionment, not just with the White House and Congress, but with other institutions. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is kind of a meta trend in American politics dating back, you know, not just to this cycle, but previous cycles, where we've seen presidents, you know, struggling with higher negatives and having trouble getting anywhere near 50% approval. But we've also seen more negative attitudes towards all kinds of institutions, everything from the U.S. Supreme Court to the media. And so we're living at a time of discontent, and there's all sorts of theories about all the ingredients that go into that. But it is there's sort of two ways to look at it politically. And one is that it's a big problem for incumbents for all the reasons I spelled out. And the other way to look at it is this is just the new normal, and it doesn't necessarily indicate a rejection of an incumbent on the ballot. And you know, we'll find out which of those interpretations is closer to the mark in November.
Time for one more caller. Mark is with us in Boulder Junction. Hi, Mark.
How are you doing today?
Good. What do you want to ask about?
Well, I'm not enthusiastic about either candidate. I was just wondering, in the scenario that neither candidate is able to still continue running, either for health or going to prison or whatever, how soon could you make a change in candidates? And are the ones that suspended their election running, are they next in line?
Gotcha. Mark, thanks for the call. Craig, I don't know what the process is for each party, but I know that each party has the thought of this possibility. It has a process in place if a presidential candidate, for whatever reason, can't keep running till November.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is whether that happens before the conventions or not. We've got a Republican convention in Milwaukee in July and a Democratic convention in Chicago in August. And so it's relatively straightforward. If for some reason the party had to switch in terms of the nomination, that would happen at the convention. I mean, the delegates would vote on that. It gets a little more complicated if something happens after the convention and there, you know, the parties have rules about, you know, there would be some sort of deliberative process involving elected officials and party officials. And so it gets kind of complicated and it gets into a little bit of uncharted territory. But if the earth moves, you know, before July and August, then those conventions could not just be interesting events, but they could be really pivotal events.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. Our last half a minute or so, Craig, what is the number one open question on your mind for this election season?
Well, I think it goes to kind of what we've been talking about in terms of motivation on both sides. I mean, there's always a battle for swing voters, and that is often decisive. But, you know, it's just I'm just sort of fascinated by this question of which party's voters are going to end up being more motivated in this election. And we've gotten a lot of cross currents because we've seen Donald Trump turn out casual Republican voters and casual conservative voters in the past, but he may have in some ways the bigger turnout lift because of the changes in the composition of the Republican electorate vis-a-vis the Democratic electorate. So turnout is going to be really fascinating to watch.
Craig, thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely.
That's Craig Gilbert, Lubar Center Fellow at Marquette University's Law School, longtime Journal Sentinel reporter, with us for a look ahead at the 2024 election. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When it comes to watching television, we have more choices than ever to find shows, movies, and other videos to watch on our home screens. As the traditional broadcast, cable, and satellite providers battle with streaming services like Netflix and Hulu for our subscription and ad dollars, another player in the digital video industry has quietly moved to the forefront. According to data from Nielsen, the top streaming service we use on our televisions is actually YouTube, not their paid service YouTube TV, but the regular free video social media platform. Viewers are spending more and more time watching videos on YouTube. That cuts into the time they might otherwise spend watching cable or streaming services. That doesn't include the time spent watching on our phones, whether it's YouTube or the dominance of TikTok in the short-form video market. It's all creating a new landscape for television producers and their audiences as they compete not just for our dollars, but our attention. You could join in at ideas@wpr.org. Send us an email. How much do you watch YouTube or TikTok? Have videos on social media eclipsed some or most of the television you watch? What do you think of the quality on videos on YouTube and other social media? Do you prefer premium content you might pay for on streaming services? Send us an email, ideas@wpr.org. Jonathan Gray is professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison, where he researches how media, entertainment, and its audiences interact. And Derek Johnson is department chair and professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison, who focuses on media industries. I talked to them last month. Here's a listen. Jonathan, why do you think audiences, especially but not exclusively younger viewers, have gravitated toward YouTube as a top streaming service?
Yeah, so I mean, two things I'd throw out there. I mean, I'm sure there are many more, but one is just access. I think when I talk to audiences, a lot of times there's a lot of confusion about, you know, they hear you should watch this show, but which service is on that? Is that on? Oh, I don't have that service. And as more and more people have cut the cord and almost everyone has internet access. And so YouTube is just there. I think the other thing is that YouTube picked up a lot of kids. A lot of kids had tablets or that they could get onto YouTube Kids. And so they became YouTube addicts at a very early age, and YouTube has tons of content for kids. And so we're starting to see a point where some of those have aged up. And so it's not just getting the kids now, it's also getting the teens and the 20s.
And Derek, in my head, you know, watching a TV show or a movie on a streaming service versus watching some clips on YouTube are different activities. But it sounds like Netflix's and Hulu's of the world see YouTube as a threat. Can you talk about how this is affecting those industries?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are a threat. They're a competitor in the sense that you can find them in the same spaces, right? You pull up your device and you can choose between different apps. You can choose between Netflix. You can choose between YouTube. Like, there's only so much time in the day. So anything that might take up our attention on a screen is potentially competing with one another. But I also think it's true that while there's competition, there's also collaboration. And a lot of these companies work together. You know, YouTube is a great site of promotion for traditional legacy television companies, television studios that create content for NBC or CBS also might create content for Netflix. So, you know, there's a lot of overlap and cooperation between these companies. So there might be like a competition mm-hmm. for dominance, but it's also an ecosystem where like these companies rely upon one another. And, you know, if one was to go extinct, like, that might be good for another competitor, but could have real implications for them too, for the ways that they depend on one another.
And John, for viewer perception, I know in the days of, you know, print newspapers, people in the industry saw a real difference between the editorial page and the news pages. So here on radio, I think of the newscast as one thing and the talk show as another thing. I know that readers of newspapers and viewers or listeners to radio, it's all one thing. How do we think of this as a whole bunch of different activities, viewing on little screens, viewing on big screens, or is it all just part of, this media environment, and it's all the same to the viewers?
Yeah, I think to many viewers, that's true. I mean, I constantly hear people tell me that they don't watch television anymore, and then they'll tell me about all the shows they think are great, meaning they're watching on their laptop or, you know, they're watching on their phone. And I think so many of us are watching on so many different devices that as we, you know, move from one to the other, we're not necessarily sort of marking the distinctions and the differences as much as used to be the case.
I want to talk, Derek, about the people creating content. If I run Netflix, well, for a while, I was producing all this original Netflix content and or bringing on stuff from other producers. If I'm YouTube, I think they dabble a little in original content, but it's mainly user created or people showing clips of stuff from everything else. How does this competition affect the stuff that gets made in the first place these days?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complex environment of content creation where, you know, YouTube does pay for content in the sense that it cuts its content creators. If they reach a certain threshold, right, you get a portion of the advertising revenue. So, you know, YouTube does have content expenses when it cuts those creators in. You know, but everyone has their own model, right? Like Netflix will pay you up front if you're a content producer trying to make television for them. You'll see a bigger upfront payment for that content. Whereas if you're working in the old network system, right, it's going to take years before you see, a profit from the show that you make, because it's got to go through one market after another before you start to see those profits. So it all just, you know, everyone has their different model of monetizing and compensating content creators.
Talking to Derek Johnson and Jonathan Gray, both with the Media and Cultural Studies Department at UW-Madison, looking at the ever-changing world of what we watch on a screen, from the old days of broadcast TV to cable, then streaming, now YouTube and TikTok becoming dominant forces in capturing our eyeballs and trying to make money out of our attention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you how your viewing habits have and haven't changed over the years. Younger listeners, do you have a big screen to watch things on, or is it all on your phone? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. John, when it comes to the stuff we see, I mean, I get, you know, there's a TikTok style, there are YouTube styles. How much do those formats shape the content that we end up seeing on them?
I mean, the short formness of it is the key thing, I think, for many people. I mean, what's weird too is all the platforms borrow from each other. You know, like my daughter watches YouTube and she thinks I'm a magician because I've seen things on Instagram, you know, 2 weeks before she has. But if you're on TikTok, you've seen it 3 months before I've seen it. But it's the short formness, I think, that's key. I think people can still often spend as much time watching, but instead of watching, say, one 45-minute episode or, you know, three sitcoms in a row, you're watching, you know, 800 small clips of something.
Yeah, I've had that experience. Like, oh, I don't have the commitment right now to watch a TV show. I'll watch a video or two. And then pretty soon I've watched the exact same block of time. Now, for Netflix, say, Derek, how much of a worry is that? I don't see Netflix coming out with a series of, you know, 45-second videos to try to compete with that.
No, I don't think that's Netflix's model. I think Netflix's model is actually fairly traditional, right? Like, they're bringing television to us in a new way via streaming platform, but they're looking at long-form content. They want to produce television series. They want to produce, feature films. Yeah, it doesn't seem to be in the pipeline for Netflix to be developing that.
Is that a worry, do you think, for people in the industry? If I'm producing 2-hour movies or 45-minute long TV shows, am I worried that there's a generation being trained to watch things in 1 minute at most increments?
I think yes. To just give you a simple answer, that seems absolutely possible.
Go ahead, John. Yeah.
For me, I think one of the key questions is it generational, or like, will they grow out of it, or is this what the generation is doing? And if I was a content creator, or if I was Netflix, that's where I'd be really worried. Is this group 10 years from now all going to be watching shows like we are, or is this the end of it?
Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Kenosha. Jim, hi.
Hi. So Google buys YouTube. Oh, what's it been since 2006? They're a very rich country, and I wanted YouTube to be a source of news for me. Try the news thing. They get stuff that's dated. Why can't they have YouTube reporters? Why can't they throw some of their millions and millions of dollars to be a legitimate news source?
Jim, interesting. I don't know that. I mean, YouTube has videos that people produce, that networks might produce, and other news sources that end up on YouTube. It doesn't seem like YouTube has at all gone into, we are going to be an original content source when it comes to news.
No, I mean, there was a brief time where YouTube was trying to develop content for its subscription service. But I think largely YouTube presents itself as the distributor, right? It's up to the users of YouTube to actually produce the content. And that's actually very convenient for YouTube in that it takes a lot of responsibility away from them. It's not their job to approve the content, to make sure that we're getting, high-quality journalism. It's just to provide the platform in which people would use it.
And thanks for that call, Jim. John, we've been mostly focusing on, you know, fiction, TV shows and movies, but as these as all these platforms change and evolve, is news getting squeezed out in some way? I know a lot of news departments have in various newspapers and elsewhere. Where do you see news going in this platform war?
Yeah, I mean, it's struggling, right? I mean, there lots of people are happy to lots of platforms are happy to distribute and to circulate, but the amount of money that comes out of that is often negligible. So, I mean, we see this, the number of venues that can actually do reporting, actually pay the money to look into a story rather than just read something off YouTube or off Google, that's going down. I mean, I'm not an optimist about the future of journalism.
Like any content, it costs money to create it, and so if we can offload that to the user who's going to be the producer, you know, well, it's up to the users to produce good news, and you know, if that's it's really on the user of YouTube and all of us collectively who are using the platform to decide, is this going to be a good platform for news or not? And I kind of share Jonathan's pessimism about the decision that we seem to have made here.
Yeah, I mean, if you want me to throw a bone of optimism, it is right that one of the challenges that led a lot of people away from the established news is is the idea of, like, you know, three great men who could tell you everything. And one of the things that YouTube does provide is the possibility for to expand the number of voices. Now, some of those voices are crazy. Some of them are wrong. Some of them are peddling conspiracy theories, but some of them are also giving, you know, sides of a story that you otherwise wouldn't hear.
And we also shouldn't pretend that the legacy news organizations weren't already disinvesting in their journalism divisions before YouTube hit the scene.
Sure.
We're talking to UW-Madison Media Studies professors Jonathan Gray and Derek Johnson about video apps like YouTube and TikTok as competition for television and streaming services. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How much of your video consumption comes from YouTube and TikTok or Instagram or the Reels on Facebook? The list goes on and on. Have you moved into particular streaming services? Have you moved on from streaming services? Or do you prefer the good old days of broadcast TV or cable or whatever era is your media golden age? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about YouTube, TikTok, and other social media platforms as top competitors to TV and streaming services. Our guests today are UW-Madison Media and Cultural Studies professors Jonathan Gray and Derek Johnson. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I'd love to hear about your screen viewing habits. Do you find yourself watching more and more, say, on YouTube and less on streaming services? Where are you in your evolution on how and what you watch on screens, big and small? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Want to give a listen to comedian Jon Stewart, who recently returned after a hiatus to hosting The Daily Show on Comedy Central. He took an audience question about whether TV is dying as more people just watch videos on their phones.
Don't you still watch TV, but you just watch it on your computer?
On TikTok, on your phone.
Right, but you understand that that's still TV. It's just you're watching it in a different delivery service. It's like heroin is heroin, whether you snort it or shoot it. It's still an opiate for the masses, as is television. You're just getting it in smaller bites, but it's still TV. We make it.
You could join in. Let us know how you get your TV, whatever you want to call it, whatever form, 800-642-1234. Jonathan, during the break, we were talking about how YouTube and other platforms serve stuff up for us. I think a lot of us have been paralyzed. I think back in the days of video stores, you know, paralyzed by the choice out there. And how do you make that decision? Well, now algorithms make it for us. Do we like that?
Well, I mean, when I do audience research, I like there's one group of people who just love studying and working out what they're going to watch. But I hear more and more people that really love things like YouTube or TikTok or Instagram because they do the work for them. It's funny because there's something nostalgic when I listen to them. It makes me think of the great experience of like watching cable TV when you've got 100 channels and you can just keep watching and it's the kind of miasma of it. And nominally your thumb's doing something, but you kind of forgotten it is. And I think that there's a joy for some people of not needing to sort of, you know, go and read the critics and find out which service is on and make the selection. You just turn it on and it'll just keep following, you know, the next recommendation. Watch that. Click, click, click. Keep going. An hour later, you're done.
Yeah. I mean, Netflix has recommendations too, but I find like Netflix still does require a fair amount of like input in order to get going. Like you still have, they're going to give you lots of recommendations, but you still have to make a choice. And that can still feel, I think, overwhelming to a lot of viewers.
Yeah. And you know, what's funny is a lot of times I've heard this from people I've interviewed where they, when I ask them how good the recommendations from Netflix are, they think the recommendations from Netflix are really bad, but they think the recommendations that YouTube or TikTok gave them for shows they should watch on Netflix are really good. So they like those algorithms, just not the Netflix one.
Let's go back to our callers. Darlene is with us in Merrill. Darlene, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Darlene?
I just wanted to say I was listening to you guys through the Ideas Network on my, you know, streaming it on my TV, but I like to hear the news from broadcasting, from regular TV, you know, internet these days, you know, people can put different things on there. You know, it's, do you believe it or not? I just like to get the news since I was a kid. And I just think that's the best way to go.
All right, Darlene, thanks for the call. Derek, thoughts on authority, I guess, reliability of sources as people encounter them in different mediums?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is about authority, but, you know, I really appreciated Darlene's comment, because one of the things that I find is hardest to find in the current environment is local, I mean, even like national broadcast news programming, right? Like there's a lot, the streaming economy is set up to deliver us our entertainment programming, but it's a lot harder to get your local news or anything that's carried on your local broadcast affiliate in the streaming environment. It's not impossible, but it's trickier.
Of course. Now I keyed in on something else Darlene just said there. She's listening to us a radio show on her TV. I don't know. That means something, Jonathan. I don't know what.
Yeah. I mean, all the media have just sort of blended into the one these days. As I said earlier, you know, the people who don't think they're watching TV when they, because they're watching it on the internet, or people who say they don't listen to any radio because, again, it's on the internet, but they're
listening. I've had people say, I like your podcast, Rob. And I'm like, yeah. What podcast? Just the archive version of this show. Yeah.
So I sat on the Peabody board for a few years judging, and what I loved is even the board members, the first, there was a category called radio podcast, and in the first few years everyone just called it the radio category, and then in the last few years everyone just called it the podcast category no matter what was in it. And people would say that was a great radio show when it was a podcast, or that's a great podcast. But
well, what I think is interesting about that, we all seem to agree, John Stewart agrees, that like it's all the same thing. But what you're describing is people still have a sense that it is different in some way, right? They strongly believe they are not watching television. And so even as things are converging, those perceived boundaries still seem to matter quite a bit.
I want to, you mentioned the word nostalgia earlier, and in my head, and maybe it's because I do live radio, I are we losing something when we don't have that shared experience where I'm watching this show at the same time as lots of other people? They're not in the room with me, but it's a common shared experience, versus we're all experiencing this thing at our leisure when we choose to stream it. Does that mean anything, Derek?
I think that's something that Netflix in particular has struggled with, where, you know, they were innovating in releasing the entire season of a series all at once. And then you would have people burn through it all in one weekend, or some people would wait and burn through it the next weekend. And as a result, there was like, you know, a quick blip of social media conversation about series, but then they'd quickly fall off the radar, right? So a lot of streaming services that followed in the wake of Netflix experimented with, like, well, let's go back to one episode a week, because that allows us to structure that shared experience and all the social media conversation that might come with it a little bit more strategically.
And just 30 seconds, Jonathan, I think sometimes by the time we're talking about a change, the new change is already coming along. What do you have your eye on next to watch for in the world of changing platforms?
Geez. I mean, what I'm most amused by is actually how we're going back to an advertising model. Most of the streamers are forcing ads on, and we're starting to see TV look a lot like it looked 30 years ago.
And look a lot more like YouTube.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And Derek, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Derek Johnson and Jonathan Gray are professors of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. We listened back to our conversation with them about YouTube and TikTok and how they're challenging streaming services, cable, and broadcast television. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's film festival season in Wisconsin. Get a preview of Milwaukee's Film Festival. Find out what's on the list of great movies to check out. Love to hear from you if you're a fan of that or any other Wisconsin film festival. Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Also tomorrow morning, what does it take to be happy? What does it mean to be happy? A Wisconsin happiness researcher joins the show for a look at meaning, contentment, purpose, and what makes life better and maybe happier. That and more, all coming up tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Last week on Food Friday, we talked about pasta salad and great ways to jazz up the old favorites. Along the way, our guest busted what he said was a myth It's the idea that you should heavily salt the water you boil pasta in. As the saying goes, make it as salty as the sea. He says some salt is fine, not quite the level of seawater. By coincidence, New York Times has a new list of the top 5 myths in cooking, and that one is on there. Long story short, salt water in the ocean is really salty, way saltier than is good for our pasta. The verdict, just salt it to taste. A couple more myths. Do you need to pre-rinse rice until the water runs clear? I don't know that I've heard that one all that often. Verdict, no. Rinsing some rice can make it less sticky in the end. And people may fight back on this one. I've heard often that you should never, ever, ever use soap on cast iron skillets. Apparently that stems from the time when there was lye in most of our soap. The verdict there, you don't always need to use soap, but a little bit for tough, hard-to-remove stuff doesn't harm the finish so much. Wish I'd heard that before I cleaned up after that frittata I made yesterday. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from a sociologist about why, even 4 years later, it still often feels like 2020 never really ended. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Waukesha doula. It's part of a series we're airing on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
When Tamara Thompson became a new mom, she was also in a new city and searching for community. She found it with a group of mothers at the Harambe Family Center in Madison.
We discussed our common experiences as African Americans while breastfeeding our babies. There were women that I formed friendships with. We watched our babies grow and achieve their milestones together.
But over time, fewer people showed up. Thompson missed the moms who left and wanted to keep the rest of the group intact. She also wanted to help Black moms extend their breastfeeding journeys. Thompson, who now lives in Waukesha, told me about this as part of a storytelling partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
So all of the people in my support group, when I noticed them coming and going and not being able to, like, reach their breastfeeding goals, I kind of took it upon myself to try to think of why. And that's when it really hit me that there are all these statistics that impacted the ways we, in my support group, African-American mothers, were able to breastfeed and what those barriers looked like for everybody else. Rather they were married, rather they were immigrants from another country, rather they were living in poverty, rather they had a certain socioeconomic status.
Thompson had more children and eventually became a breastfeeding peer counselor with the African-American Breastfeeding Alliance of Dane County.
And all of these words started coming at me, like social determinants of health and maternal mortality and infant mortality and all of these different things. And as I started to kind of analyze what this meant for who I was and how I became a mother, it took me back.
It also took her forward. Thompson decided she wanted to become a doula. Then she established Maroon Calabash with fellow birth workers. The group's mission is to support Black parents through cultural traditions and modern medicine.
It meant like revolutionary love. It meant that people were going to be celebrated and that there's going to be things associated with childbirth and pregnancy that weren't associated before. Things like pleasure or joy or celebration, right? It's a birthday party, right? And for people who make the decision that they don't want to continue their pregnancy, we're celebrating their independence. We're celebrating that they get to decide what is right for their life. And some people are not going to agree with our philosophy, but we still will defend our right to have it and to practice in those types of ways.
Thompson was looking at pregnancy holistically.
I'm going to be here for you. I'm going to bring you water. I'm going to hold your hair. I'm going to tell you that you're beautiful, and I'm going to usher your baby into this world with you or hold your hand through whatever you decide is right for you, whether that's adoption or if there's a stillbirth that we're expecting, that we know that the baby is not going to cry at the end of this labor. I will hold that space for you, and I will be there for you.
For Thompson, being a doula merged the worlds of medicine and traditional birth work. And as her community of doulas and midwives expanded, so did her passion for reproductive justice.
What if we as doulas and midwives are agents of social change? And what if we disrupt those patterns that epigenetics will say, being predisposed to stress levels, racism, discrimination, lack of fair housing, lack of food, all of the environmental injustices that we know? What if we replace that during pregnancy with joy, celebration, pleasure, good food that smells good and tastes good? What if we love on people? That, to me, is successfully pairing together the old and the new. That is the way that we change the world. That's it. All power to the pregnant people.
Tamara Thompson shared her story with us as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Now imagine this scenario. It's a presidential election year. Donald Trump is facing off against Joe Biden. Both sides say it's the most important election in years. The results could have existential consequences. And the election is going on in the shadow of a COVID-19 uptick among ongoing arguments over vaccines and other safety measures. Am I talking about 2020? Sure. Am I talking about 2024? Sure. Why does it sometimes feel like nothing much has changed? Is it because not all that much has changed? How much of that pivotal year still affects our day-to-day lives? Our next guest is a sociologist who says 2020 revealed weaknesses in our social fabric and that its echoes are still defining American society to 2024 and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like much has changed since the height of the pandemic? Do you think we as a nation have learned lessons from it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology and director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. His newest book is called 2020, One City, Seven People in the Year, Everything Changed. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Really nice to be here. What a day it's been.
An amazing day with the eclipse and everything. Yeah.
There's no solar eclipse in 2020. That might be the one.
That's true. One big difference. Now, you write in the intro to the book, Eric, I'm going to quote here, "The story of what happened in 2020 and in the pandemic years that followed goes deeper with more expansive consequences than conventional accounts acknowledge." What, big picture, what do you think is missing in the way we talk and think about the pandemic?
Well, so much of the conversation about the pandemic has to do with, you know, really important things. How many people got sick? How many people died? And those things are essential. But there's a deeper story about what happened to us in the United States as a country. And it's my view that 2020 intensified, accelerated, and hardened a lot of serious social problems, chasms, in ways that are with us today. So we became even more distrustful of each other, of government, of science. We became even more divided, and that probably would have been hard for us to believe given where we were in 2020, but here we are in what feels like a very explosive 2024. And this kind of sense that there's something off that really kind of got whipped up in 2020 is with us today. So we find ourselves in this strange situation where, even though numbers tell us, you know, that the economy is much better than it was, that inflation is down, that we're faring much better than other countries that have struggled to recover from the pandemic, you know, economically at least, it just feels like something is fundamentally off right now.
Something you highlight in the book, and I hadn't thought of it in exactly this way, Eric, is, you know, this is a global pandemic, but some things are very unique here in the United States, especially compared to other, you know, large developed countries. In the United States, homicides went up during the pandemic. Didn't happen in comparable countries. Reckless driving and road vehicle deaths went up. Didn't happen in other comparable countries. Our per capita direct COVID death rate, excess mortality rate, higher than those other comparable countries. There were some things about this pandemic that were uniquely American. What's behind that?
Well, it's absolutely right. And in a way, you know, I was responding to the debate at the time that said, when a society has its ordinary way of doing things transformed, when there's a trauma, when patterns are disrupted, you can expect what sociologists call anomie to take place, in this kind of sense of moral disconnection, people acting out. And so the theory from a lot of journalists during 2020 was these crises that are happening in the United States, like the spike, not just in gun violence, which you'd expect here because we have a lot more guns than most other societies, but in things like reckless driving and vehicular manslaughter, that must be due to this disruption. The problem is that societies across the planet had that disruption. In fact, even though Americans like to complain about the lockdowns, and it felt really bad to be constrained the way we were, but we never really had full-on lockdowns like they had in China or in Italy or in Australia. But we did have this really unusual spike in Americans acting out towards one another. Look, there's deep reasons for this, and it's a fascinating theme for me in my research. But I have to say that we were uniquely misled in the United States in 2020. Most governments took this occasion to try to build solidarity and bond people together. And unfortunately, leadership in this country took advantage of 2020 as a wedge issue to try to divide our society. And we wound up brawling in the streets and in Walmarts over things like whether or not it was okay to wear a mask. I think we lost an opportunity to bond together, and we're still paying a price for that.
And you write that there were leadership failures at different levels and in different ways. You point toward President Trump in his mixed messaging, announcing CDC mask requirements, for example, or guidelines, and saying he would be ignoring them. But also in states that did take more stringent measures, being kind of heavy-handed and arbitrary in enforcement. There were failures you see at different levels.
There were a lot of failures. I mean, let's start with the top, because I think that matters most. And, you know, presidents always have a lot of power, but when there's a new crisis and people can't figure out what's going on, we really turn to the White House and the big federal agencies to define the situation for us. And it just mattered that, you know, in the beginning of the year 2020, you know, Trump was expressing great confidence that China had everything under control, and that a few weeks later he said he wasn't letting American passengers on a cruise ship that had COVID back onto land because he liked the numbers where they were, and that the thing would magically disappear by Easter, or that, you know, you could inject yourself with disinfectant and maybe that would get rid of it. I mean, all that stuff just generated chaos and confusion at a time when we just needed sanity in this country. That said, I think it is important to note that the failure was not only at the top. I live in New York State, where the governor at the time, Governor Cuomo, was in many ways a voice of sanity and reason for the country, because he just talked about what was happening, except he refused to acknowledge the horrible situation in nursing homes in New York. And New York, like many other states, had this thing where nursing home workers don't make enough money to have, you know, stable, you know, one job career in that field. They tend to work from nursing home to nursing home in a precarious existence, and they wound up carrying the disease into our most vulnerable population. So New York, like many other states, had very high nursing home deaths. And instead of acknowledging it and talking about the problem, as honest as he was in other areas, the governor just kind of tried to fudge it. And I think America suffered from all of that.
Eric Kleinenberg is with us, social sciences professor at New York University, talking about his new book, 2020, One City, Seven People in the Year Everything Changed, and the impact of the pandemic on American society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did the government's response or lack of same to the pandemic affect the way you feel about politics, your trust in leaders in our system? How much do you think the pandemic contributed to loneliness, isolation, decline in trust? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Eric Kleinenberg from New York University, looking at the lasting impact of the 2020 pandemic and election year on American society. He's got a new book out. It's called 2020, One City, Seven People, The Year Everything Changed. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Eric, something you tackle in your book and in a recent piece you wrote, I think, in the New York Times, a lot of us think of the pandemic as accelerating loneliness. That's not exactly how things played out. What did you see when it came to loneliness? What is your bigger worry of the way we got disconnected there?
Well, I think a lot of Americans are trying to figure out why we feel so off today. And a very powerful argument from the Surgeon General's office is that, you know, we're lonelier than we've ever been before. And of course, in 2020, when we were locked up and we stopped going to the office and we didn't go to school, a lot of Americans worried that, you know, we'd hit a loneliness epidemic and things would be terrible. Well, I interviewed enormous numbers of people who were living alone, including in New York, where things were really bad in the early stage of the pandemic. And it was so fascinating, Rob. You know, people said that they felt in some ways like they, you know, they miss physical contact. They miss that kind of physical intimacy. But they said, surprisingly, that because they were living through this crisis in sync with everybody else in their family, you know, in the world, and because they were having these phone conversations and FaceTime and Zoom conversations with so many people, more than they usually do, they said they didn't feel lonely in the conventional sense. What they felt was that they had been left to themselves, like left on their own to fend for themselves. And I actually think that is a durable problem in America, that when everything was falling apart, when we had that feeling like the bottom had fallen out and we were just kind of tumbling through space, who knew how we would land? Who knew if our job would be there when this pandemic ended? Who knew what our financial situation would be and what other damage would happen? Who would be alive and who would not? Americans didn't really have a place to turn for answers. And I think that's part of the problem of a federal government that is sowing chaos. But also I think that's a feeling that people have to this day. It's like we saw the country not perform. We saw people not stand up for each other in the way that we might have in this moment. We saw the government kind of disappear. It showed up eventually. But I think a lot of Americans were scarred by that experience. And the fact that we have largely refused to talk about what happened in 2020, that we've kind of have this will not to know about the thing we experienced collectively, has meant that in some way we're trapped in that. And one reason I wrote this book is as a kind of an invitation for all of us to process what we live through and to try to learn from the mistakes, you know, before the next crisis happens. And I think also before the next election.
Let's bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Racine. Steve, hello.
Hello. I am so happy to be listening to you guys. Yes, I fully agree with the fact that we as Americans don't know where to turn. We're getting information on depending on what news outlet you're listening to. It's the same but completely different because it's the Republicans' fault or it's the Democrats' fault or it's this or that. And we as, you know, the peons, if you will, us people down in the lower ranks, even though I own a small business, we're not really sure what to do with all this. And it's so frustrating.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I think, Steve, not alone in that feeling, Eric, and this idea that, I don't know, our reality, our response, our public health all of a sudden was a partisan issue, and it depended on which partisan side you happen to be listening to.
It was so strange. I mean, look, health organizations internationally issued concerns about what they called an infodemic. Unfortunately, you know, President Trump was responsible for more misinformation or disinformation about the pandemic than anybody in this country, for sure. But it's hard to get reliable news in general. I think, you know, that's what your caller's explaining. And look, it's not just partisan news outlets and the fact that, you know, you can easily go to find someone who supports your ideology. It's that we have this kind of chaotic media environment now where a lot of people are getting news from TikTok and social media, and those sites are ripe for disinformation. And I don't think anyone has a really clear sense of where we're getting news today and how to get reliable information when it matters most. In a pandemic, it's really important for us to be able to find out the truth, like what helps and what doesn't help, what's going to put you at risk and what won't. So having a president who says the CDC says you should be wearing a mask, but I won't do it, or you know, inject Clorox, that could help, or use this medication, or maybe you shouldn't use the vaccine. All that stuff is really going to make it difficult for us to act collectively and with some kind of cohesion. And we need to do that to get through the hardest times.
Thanks again for that call. Eric, I want to look toward the future now. Is there a way to start to rebuild that cohesion, to rebuild these sort of abstract seeming concepts like trust?
I think it's going to be difficult, and there's no, you know, magic formula, but I do call attention in my book to one amazing bright spot, because I think it's important for us to tell this story about 2020. And that is that throughout the country, we saw the rise of these very local mutual aid networks, organizations that ordinary people started to help out their neighbors, and they provided all kinds of support to one another, from food to diapers to cleaning supplies to basic care services. I write about a woman named Nuala O'Doherty in the book. There's seven key characters in the book, mm-hmm. one from every borough in New York City and a couple of others. Nuala started this amazing network in Queens to help a very diverse immigrant neighborhood get through the pandemic. And I have to tell you, I checked in on her recently, and the mutual aid network that she set up in 2020 to handle COVID is now the Jackson Heights Immigration Center, and they're helping new migrants into New York City get the services that they need to stay afloat. And so that's a solution that's starting to rebuild by just taking care of the people around us. And that is a really important part of our American culture as well. We talk a lot about our hyper-individualism, and there's a lot to be worried about today, but there is something to celebrate and lean into also. And that is we have at times had great capacity to act collectively, to participate in community life. And I think that's the kind of thing we really need to be doing now across the country.
And Eric, in just our last half a minute or so, you profile, as you said, seven people in the book. How important is it for us to just talk to each other about our experiences during COVID and not shut the door on it? Again, just in our last half a minute.
Yeah, if there's one thing that I could prescribe at this moment, it's for us to face our experiences together, you know, gather together in your local library or in your school, when you drop off your kids, in your senior center, share stories about what you lived through in 2020. And we might find that that's a good way for us to remember and to recover, and to build the kinds of ties that we need to strengthen our society for the next thing.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Really been a pleasure. Take care, Rob.
You too. That's Eric Kleinenberg, social sciences professor at New York University. His new book is called 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new Wisconsin law will put Asian American and Hmong American history in particular into schools around the state. We'll find out what that means for students and dig into some of that history. And the NCAA women's basketball tournament was just the latest high-profile moment in women's sports in the U.S. We'll look at that growing interest in various women's sports leagues, that and more, tomorrow here on Central Time.